And it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight. I asked Holly this evening how I should introduce her and what should be said, or if any. And she was very hesitant. In fact, she just wouldn't give me any information. But I found out that she has been very active in the field of alcoholism in several different ways. And then to bind it up, it came out that she is solid, and solid only on the big book. And I think that is the best introduction we can give. Holly M. from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to thank you for inviting me here. And you're very kind. You're very warm, wonderful people. I go a lot of places, but you have a certain beautiful hospitality here that I certainly appreciate. There was one thing I've noticed, especially about the women here. They too are very hospitable, very lovely people. And that's... When I walked through that door yesterday, every woman down there walked up to me that wasn't busy and told me her name, welcomed me here, and shook hands with me. You know, most times women look at you when you walk into places if, you know, you might have dirty underwear on or something. You know, you begin to scratch yourself. Well, I had a very pleasant time today. Very pleasant. Now, I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow description of my drinking. That's not necessary. For the simple reason is, I think everybody in here knows how to drink. All you got to do is open your mouth and swallow it. It generally winds up either upstairs or downstairs or somewhere or other. You know, there was once a man that constantly heckled another man about all of his affiliations. First, he started in on him about his church. This man was in the program. He wouldn't say anything to him about it. He let him heckle him and heckle him and heckle him. So he said, well... So he couldn't get a rise out of him, so he started in on him about AA. He said, I've heard you read those 12 steps. I've saw it in your books. He says, you know, after all, he says, one of those traditions you have is real silly. He says about the name AA should never be brought into public controversy. He said, now that's stupid. He said, but the simple reason is, he said, you know, with all those different kind of people that you have in AA, there's got to be some kind of gossip. And he says, and with all those different kinds of personalities that you've got in AA, he said, there's got to be some filth. He said, the thing must be something like Noah's Ark with all those animals. He said, the man says, you know one thing? He says, I think he hit it right. He says, it is something like Noah's Ark. He said, we might have a little gossip. He said, we might have a little filth. He said, but being like the Ark, everybody that stays in it stays dry. And, so I guess that's why we can get along with one another. The big book, which the gentleman told you I'm quite fond of, is that big book. I didn't like it at first, now I'll tell you that right off the reel. But I learned to love it. It says there that our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we are like now. I like to think of and begin with what happened. What did happen? Well, I will tell you exactly what happened to me. After trying many, many things, but I never tried anything too seriously because, well, I just hadn't made up my mind that alcohol wasn't the problem. You know, it was other people's meddling with me. And first I thought, you know, it might be marriage or And I knew I was drinking long before I ever got married to anybody. And, well, you know, marriages, they always felt, you know, like, well, they're like vaccinations. On me, they don't take. The first man I married, he had taken the, he was bound by the vows of poverty. The second one I married was bound by the vows of chastity. But that's another story. We won't go into that. But then, but then nevertheless, I started drinking when I was around about 14 years old, I suppose, out of curiosity. I was born and raised in a little town in Ohio that reminds you very much of Peyton Place. It was one of those places where people do everything they're big enough to do and then peep out behind their lace curtains to see if you know they're doing it. One of those kind of things. And my grandparents, they were teetotalers. You know, they were really and truly teetotalers. My grandfather had a bottle of whiskey that he kept there in the drawer. And he had rock candy and herbs and a whole lot of junk in this bottle. And he had arthritis, and about two or three times a year, he would go over to this dresser drawer and he'd pull it out and, he'd cripple over there. Oh, my gracious. You know, it hurt him so bad. He'd cripple over there, and he'd take two, three swigs out of this bottle, and then he'd sit down and rub his leg, and he'd get up and walk away. So I watched him do this, and I said, now that must be pretty potent stuff. So I walked over to the drawer one day and took two, three swigs out of it and sat down. I got up and crippled away. And so from there on in, I thought this was pretty nice stuff. So that, my first drink I took it out of curiosity, and I stayed curious for a number of years after that. See, very curious. But what happened, as I started to tell you, what happened? Is that what the big book says? What really happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. One Saturday night, I was sitting at my kitchen table. And this was a miracle. It was the beginning of a miracle. For me to be home on a Saturday night was certainly a miracle. And here I sit home. And by that time, I was not, well, you shouldn't say a wino. Women are not winos, they're winettes. And, So I was sitting there drinking a bottle of wine, as usual, and a story came on over the radio. Now, I did not turn this radio on to this particular station, because when you're in my condition, you hear voices all the time anyway, so you don't turn radios on or off. And this story came on, and it was called The Glass Crutch. And it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. Now, I do not today remember any of the ingredients of this story. All I can remember was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And as I sat there drinking my wine, I thought to myself, now, if she just quit drinking whiskey and get some wine, her problems would be over with. That's her problem. But do you know, that was the beginning, my friends, of a miracle. Because from there on in, now, I didn't do anything about this right away. It was 6 or 7 years after my hearing this story on the radio that I did anything about it, because I said, if there's anything wrong with Holly, I can straighten it out myself. But do you know, all during those 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into the fellowship, this did not happen every day, nor did it happen every week or every month, but at different intervals. It seemed as though when I would walk down the street, the heel plates on my shoes would beat out the words, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. I can remember at certain times the clock on the wall did not say tick-tock, it said, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. I remember one time sitting in the living room trying to read the newspaper, and it seemed as if every word on that newspaper said, the glass crutch. And I said, my Lord, what is this? You know, if any of you have ever read The Hound of Heaven, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, because that's exactly what I went through. Now, so finally that story came back to me again. Just the words, the glass crutch. Every word on that newspaper said that. And I remember that it said we'd be the first number in the book. Well, I said, well, I'm going to see if it is. And I opened the telephone book, and there it was, the first number in the book. Mm-hmm. But in this drunken, sodden mind of mine, well, of course, I had now reached the stage of zombieism. That's if you drink, you don't get drunk. And if you don't drink, you don't get sober. You're just like a zombie. But I said, I'll try it. I'll try it. You see, people had always, you know, somebody was always telling me before this, you know, what you need in your life. No one ever but one person ever told me you should not drink. Everybody told me what you need in your life. Somebody's always going to give you the antidote. I had a friend there, bless her heart. She always gave me the antidote. She always told me, now, you know, dear, I know exactly what's wrong with you. See, she was the old doll. She needed me at that time. She was about the age I am now, I guess. And don't count on your fingers. You haven't got enough hands. So anyway, she would always say to me, now, dear, I would try to explain to her how I felt. That was before this happened. And she would always say to me, now, dear, I know exactly what's wrong with you. I'd try to tell her about my headaches, my hangovers. I would try to tell her about my blackouts, but I didn't know there were blackouts then. I just thought I was losing my mind on installment plans. I didn't know what was going on. I would try to tell her these things. And she'd say, now, dear, I know exactly what's wrong with you. Now, tonight, when we go out, you know, she needed me to go with her because she felt that the old doll needed the young doll, you know, to go out with her, because she felt that no self-respecting gentleman would buy the young doll a drink without buying the old doll a drink. I know how that works. I played on both leagues. I know how it goes, see. But anyway, she would say, now, dear, tonight, when we go out, if you'll just drink a little olive oil, you won't get sick. Just drink a little. Now, I remember drinking a little olive oil, and instead of being a long, tall, puking drunk, I was a long, tall, greasy puking drunk. That's the only difference. And then she'd tell me, now, I'd try to tell her about how I felt the next morning. She said, oh, I know about hangovers, dear. You don't need to ever have a hangover. She says, now, if you will just take a bottle of beer and open it and let it set down beside of your bed and let it get flat, and drink that first thing in the morning, you won't have a hangover. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. There's no way in hell I could go to sleep with a full bottle of beer down beside the bed. So, so that didn't work. So I tried many other things that people would tell me. You know, I would go to the doctor, and I would be all broke out with a rash, and I would try to tell him, well, my nylon sweater broke it out, or my wool sweater broke it out. And one time he asked me how much wine I drank, and I got another doctor. I said, no, he don't know what he's talking about, see. And then there was times, you know, so the physician, he was no good for me, not at that time. And then, you know, I would try to talk to the clergyman, and bless his heart, I lied to him, and he knew I was lying, so I give up on that. And, well, that's another story altogether anyway. Because I remember one time you talking about straight insanity, if there ever was insanity. I'd gotten drunk everywhere anybody could get drunk. So when it comes down to the second step, I know what insanity is. But let's get back before the first one even. So this particular time, when I finally made up my mind, I will call that number. I looked in the book and there it was. And I called the number and I told the lady, I said, look, I got a friend out here. I said, I think she's losing her mind. And the lady said, would you like to have somebody come out and talk to you? I said, oh, no, no, goodbye. 24 or 48 hours later, I'm sitting right there in the same chair. I don't know. Still in my state of zombieism. And I call again. And finally, the lady got my name out of me. And she said, well, I'll have someone call you. So she did. Bless her heart. She had a lady call me, and the lady said to me, now, if you've got anything out there to drink, get rid of it. Well, I did. I drank it up. And and I was, by the time she came to take me to my first meeting, I was still in this stupid state. But, you know, alcohol is everything that big book says it is, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Now, I had been in the state of zombieism, I don't know for how long. But just before time for the lady to take me to my first meeting, two of my good buddies came by there and they gave me a couple of drinks of something. It was the same as pouring Kolol on the dying embers. I got drunk. But anyhow, I got high, rather. Yeah. So she took me to that meeting. And I don't remember too much about that meeting. But there's one thing that stuck to my mind. The next morning when I woke up, these words came to my mind, rarely have we ever seen a person fail. just that clearly. That was the second miracle. Rarely have we ever seen a person fail. So I went back to my second meeting to find out what they were drinking that rarely ever failed, you know? They gotta be drinking something that don't fail. So she said to me, oh, I hated my sponsor. Well, I had four, to tell you the truth, because when I walked into that first meeting, three other women jumped up and said, they thought I was going to get to be my pallbearers, you know. I look so bad. We'll help you with her. Well, I've outlived most of them. And, but then, this one, she stuck to me. In those days, we really, when we sponsored a person, we sponsored them. I mean, you got sponsored. And she did. She was a good sponsor. And she would read this who me on me. And I hated that woman for reading this who me. You know, she had buck teeth and she'd look at me and grin and she'd say, just answer yes to three, dear, and you're in. And I said, now this old biddy must be getting 50 cents a yes or something. So she'd read off one of them and I hated that who me. She'd say, is drinking spoiling your reputation? Oh, my gracious. No, I said, no, that's about as stupid a question as I ever heard of, you know. And then she would ask some of the, I thought that who me, it had the dumbest question. One of the dumbest things I ever heard in my life. Do you seek a lower environment while drinking? Why, no, I didn't seek a lower environment while drinking. I merely created a lower environment while drinking. See. But the dumbest question this woman asked me was this. Do you prefer to drink alone? Do you if I'm buying it, yes. If you're buying it, no. I said, I don't know what in the world is wrong with these people. They ask these stupid questions, you know. So she said, now you just keep coming, dear. You just keep coming. You keep. And when I didn't keep coming, she just kept coming after me, you know. Well, those guys, you know. And I was scared of her. She was bigger than me, and I was scared of her, you know. And then, you know, I didn't know whether those teeth came out or not, and I wasn't going to monkey with her. And so I just kept coming, because she said that was the thing to do. And then I had my other sponsor. She was more of a milder person, more reasonable. This other was a fanatic, I'm telling you. You know, she's like I am now. You know, I took after it, rubbed off. And, well, you know, it does. You know, association brings on assimilation, you know. But this other, she was a milder one, and she said to me, I said to her, Mary, where do we go from here? I said, what am I to look for in this program? And you know what she said? Yourself. So that's who you, what's what you're supposed to look for? You. You're the real you. She said, now look at this as if you were going on a trip. And I said, no, no, hell no. I've been on enough trips, I know. She said, well, look upon it as if as an adventure. And that is the way that I've tried to look at AA. That is the way I try to live AA, as if it is an adventure. And I call these 12 steps my journey into sobriety, because that's exactly what they are. It is the journey, you know, that you and I take one step at a time. And it's a known fact, when one starts on his or her journey into sobriety, it's like going on a journey anywhere else. First and foremost, if you and I were going this evening or this afternoon on a journey, the first thing that we would do would be to take our car to a reputable mechanic. Because why? We want to see that it is in good condition. So sometimes when we first come into AA, it is necessary that we go to see a good physician to get ourselves. One doesn't feel well, he won't think well. Now, the next thing when one starts on his journey is that it is a known fact, it is suggested that one should have four good tires. He should have five. But it's well that he has four good tires. Now, what are the four good tires that one needs when he starts on this journey? One is communication, so that you and I can talk with one another. That's the greatest one. Then there is identification. You know, do I really belong here? Say, can I identify? Then self-examination. What am I going to do about myself after I'm here? Now, then I need determination. I'm going to stay here. That's where I belong. See. So when one starts on his journey, again, It is a known fact when we start out. It is well that we get it mapped out for us. In what direction are we going? You know. So 10 to 1, you would possibly go to AAA and you would tell them where you wanted to go and they would map it out. Like these 12 steps are mapped out for us. Now, it is a known fact, if I wanted to drive from where I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to San Francisco, and I would go to AAA, they would tell me, now you will take 94 West to 80 and stay on 80. And we doubt seriously whether you'll get lost or not. Just stay there. Now, the big book says, same thing. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths. It also says, rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. Get on there, just like they would tell you at AAA. If you want to go there, now here's the way to go. Now follow this path. And I doubt seriously whether you're going to get lost or not. Now there's another thing that's very, very important. When one has his car in good condition, and he's got his route all mapped out for him, it's a known fact, unless you want your trip or your journey all messed up, is to not obey the signs that you see along the road. This is of utmost importance for a safe journey, that we obey these signs. Now, one of the signs that we see most frequently along the road is a stop sign. S-T-O-P, stop. And we will identify that stop sign with the first step. You know? Which tells us that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. There's a sign that says stop. Now, you will see no sign that says taper off. It says stop. It says stop. Now, what are some of the stop signs that I ran through? I saw all those stop signs and I ran through every one of them. The first stop sign I saw there was that sneaking sign. When I had to start sneaking drinks, it was time to stop right there, you know, sneaking a drink. You went out and you bought it and you worked for it and you brought it home, now you're going to sneak and drink it. It's time to stop. If I've got to sneak something in my house, I got to sneak it in there. And then to hide it after I get in there. You know, hide it under there. It's mine, I bought it. Why do you sneak and hide things, Holly? Something's wrong. Anytime you gotta hide it and then lie about it. Somebody say, what's that doing? I don't know. I don't know. And then you start gulping real fast. You gotta drink it down, you know, real quick, you know. In other words, real fast. You might even drink it out of a straw so that none will evaporate, you know. Gulping. People come to your house and you're gonna serve them, you know, and you go out there in the kitchen and you serve them in those little insult glasses like that. And you get yourself a gratitude glass. Okay. And that isn't enough, so you just pick up the bottle and drink out of it right quick and gulp it down. And you come back in, you know, and you drank it down so fast you got tears running down your face. And someone says, what's the matter? What happened? You say, oh, I don't know. It's my hay fever, dear. I don't know. You know, you're out there in the kitchen gulping it down, yeah? So now, I've started lying, sneaking, hiding, and gulping. That's going through a stop sign. Every one of them is time to stop. Then we begin to get, at least I did, pardon me for using the word we, friends, but I'm so accustomed to that word we, because, see, I had to learn to use that word we. I was so selfish before everything I ever said was I, me, and mine, you know. So now I get suspicious. Oh, I'm suspicious to the point of paranoia, you know. I'm suspicious of everybody. Everybody's talking about me. Everybody's running me down, you know. See? Everything. Then I get quarrelsome. You always start a quarrel. You know why you start a quarrel? You know, that's keeping anybody from telling you what you've done, so you start an argument first. Always go home mad. Make it your business. Don't always go in mad, you know. See? Beat them to the draw, see? Make sure that you're going to be mad. And then you know, we get, and someone starts talking to you, and you want to rationalize everything. Everything is rationalization. You know, just like, you know, we try to use rationalization in this program. Well, you know, a friend of mine told me about this rationalization. They're the same as masturbation. You're just screwing yourself, you know. not very nice. And then, you know, we start deliberately making other people angry. You know, you like to deliberately make other people angry. That creates anxiety in them. We like to get everybody upset, you know. Oh, don't you just love that, you know, when you're drunk, you know. You come home and you want back out, but you don't know how to get back out, so you make everybody mad at you, you know. See, yeah, you're not woman enough or man enough to say, well, I'm going out for a little while this evening. No, that wouldn't do it. You got to make everybody mad first, you know. So if you can just get them upset, you know, so you start walking up and down the floor, and you want them to say, what's the matter with you? So you walk some more. And then finally the person says, look, will you stop walking up and down the floor? You make me nervous. And you say, see, that's it. You make me nervous. I'm leaving. That's all you want. So we deliberately keep other people upset. We like that. We like to see people upset. Then they won't question you. And after you've raised more hell than the one-legged man at a dance, you turn around and say, dear, did I do something to offend you? You know. Oh, we know how to do it, don't we? Those are stop signs. Now, the remorse. Now, have you ever felt guilty about doing something that you didn't do? You know? Don't care what it is, you feel guilty. Doesn't make any difference. Well, like the man, you know, he sat there, you know, and he had thrown his guts up. Oh, he had thrown his guts up. And he sat there. He says, now, I know that there couldn't be anything left in me. So he sat there and he went to sleep. And when he woke up, his dog and cat was sitting there. And he said, now, hell, I know I didn't eat them. That's what he said. So he felt guilty about that. So you and I, that's the way I felt. Whether I did it or not, if I walked in somebody's house and they had something that was broke 25 years before I ever knew them, and they say, you know, this guy broke, I said, you don't think I did it, did you? You know. Guilty. Constantly a feeling of guilt, a constant feeling of remorse, always. Those, my friends, were my stop signs. Then as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says yield. We will identify that with the second step, that we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. Yield. Which tells me, give over before you give out. Yield. You know, there are many times that some of us say that we have a problem with the spiritual part of the program. As far as I'm concerned, the whole program is spiritual. But many of us say, well, you know, I just can't buy that second step. Well, no, it's not for sale. It's free. No. Well, you know, this power greater than me, you know, I just can't conceive of this sort of thing. You know, I think I can make it on something else. Well, now, I have to go by what that big book says. See, I love that book. It says, that big book tells me, remember, you deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you, but there's one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And that says so in the book. Now, Holly didn't say that. The book says so. That's exactly what it said. Well, you know, after all, I don't know. I just can't buy that. You know, let me tell you something. Do you remember? Well, you might say, I got a good doctor, and I got a good psychiatrist, so I don't need that God part of the program. Well, that's fine. Doctors are okay. You know, we need doctors. Well, psychiatrists, some of them are, you know. but nevertheless, do you remember the story about Humpty Dumpty? You learned at your mother's knee when you were a child. You know that egg, Humpty Dumpty, said, Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall, and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. You know why? Let us look at the good doctors, if you will, as the king's horses. Because all good doctors work like a horse. We will look at the psychiatrists as king's men. They always kind of go around with their nose up in the air when they're not jumping out of windows. Present company accepted if they're here, you know. Well, okay, now look at it like this. Now, as I said, the king's horses, these are the doctors. The king's men, these are the psychiatrists. Now, there are some good psychiatrists, and I know there are, so I'm just kidding with you. But the king's horses and the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And sometimes we go, we have a good doctor, and maybe you got a good psychiatrist, but you can't get yourself back together again. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. You cannot build a bridge across the king's nose. You call on the doctor, and you call on the psychiatrist. It's like Humpty Dumpty. He called on the king's horses, and he called on the king's men. But he forgot to call on the king. That's where it is, you know? That's where it is, you know? It says so in the book, so it's got to be right, you know? And then again, you might say, well, you know, after all, I can get along without that king business. Well, I'm going to tell you one thing. I hope it never happens to one in this room. So I can manage it. No. If you think that you can manage it, promise me one thing. The next time you get drunk and you get sick and you go to puke and try stopping puking in the middle of a puke, you can't. You can't do it. It just doesn't work that way. Yeah. It really and truly doesn't. I tried it and I almost died, you know. Because, see, I remember those mornings. You know, those mornings that you insult your gut, you get up there, and you feel like you got to have a hair of the dog that bit you, you know, and your stomach says, look, don't send that crap down here this morning. And your mind says, oh, I got to have it. So you send some down, and your stomach said, I said, don't do that, and up it comes. Yeah. So you try it again, and finally your mind says, look, I don't give a damn what you do. You can send it down if you want to. Now here's the insanity part of it. You finally get one to stay down, and here you are. You've insulted your guts, and you say, I finally got one to stay down. And you're so happy about it. You've insulted every intestine you had, and you're glad, you know. And you mean to tell me that is not insanity? When I insult everything within me and say, whiskey, I'm so glad, wine, I'm so glad I got you to stay down, and you're happy. You're so happy you cry. You cry because you can't stop, you know? So just try to stop puking in the middle of a puke. You'll never make it. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, wrong way, do not enter. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. Wrong way, do not enter when you think. Well, you know, after all, I'm sober now. And so I can handle it on my own. I can handle everything on my own, you know, that's fine. I think that I've got to do it my way. Oh, no, I don't have to do it my way. My way is what got me into all the trouble, you see. See, I have something now going for me. It says, made a decision. Made a decision. That's that word right there, decision. See, decision determines one's destiny. The decision that I make each and every day determines how I'm going to get along that day. It determines my destiny. You say, well, you know, I don't know about this third step. You know, I don't know whether I can turn it over to God or not. And some people, you know, think, oh, I just turn it over to God. I just turn everything over to God. This step didn't say that. You know what this step said? Make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Over to the care of. You know, God's not a garbage pail. Oh, I just turn everything over there. Over to the care of. When you take your money to the bank, do you just walk flippantly in there and say, hey, bank, here's some money. Give it to them and walk on out. No, you've got something to do too, don't you? You turn it over to the care of the bank. Why do you turn it over to the care of the bank? Why? You got books, haven't you? You want them to take care of it. You didn't give them people your money, though. Why did you turn it over to the care of them? Because you want a few friends' benefits, don't you? Mm-hmm. You would like for that money to make a little money for you, wouldn't you? So you turn it over to the care of the bank. It's too much for you to take care of all by yourself. So you turn it over to their care. If you have, shall we say, any bank book in the world, your checking account, when you put that money in the checking there, True, it doesn't draw any interest. But you have to keep account of the checks you write, don't you? You have to keep account of your deposits and your withdrawals and those checks that you write. In other words, you just don't take that money and throw it in there in the checking account and say, hey, now you all pay the light bill, the gas bill, the telephone bill. Here's the money. Y'all gone about your business. Uh-uh. They think it's crazy. Over to the care of your savings account and your savings. You know it's going to draw you some interest. But there's something you have got to do, too. You don't just dump it there and walk off and leave it. So when I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, into His keeping, because you see, there's days, just like right now, I need to draw on the interest. I need His help. And it's going to be there. See? But it is a funny thing. When you haven't got anything but crap, you say, well, I turn that over to God. I just throw it away. But if it's good, you want it all yourself, don't you? Mm-hmm. You don't want to turn that over to His care, because I can take care of this myself. But anything that's not worth a damn, oh, I'll just turn that over to God. Uh-uh. Just turn it over to God. But that's one little word that you and I sometimes fail to see. Over to the care of Him. So, well, you know, after all, I just can't put my trust in something that I can't see. Oh, that is a beautiful one. Now, I can't trust something I can't see. Well, you know, and I just can't believe in something. How am I going to turn my life and my will over to care of something that I just can't believe ever existed? I don't know. Well, let me ask you, has anybody in this room, since he's sober, since you've been sober now, have you ever met Shakespeare since you've been sober? Well, you might have met him when you were drunk. You meet a lot of people then. But since you've been sober, you never met Shakespeare. Well, how do you know Shakespeare existed? You said, well, by his works. Well, how do you know God didn't exist and by his works? That's how he existed. That's how you know he existed, by his works. So, yeah, I believe in Shakespeare. I not only believe in Shakespeare, I believe the old boy was one of us. You know? Because didn't he say, oh, that man should put an enemy into his mouth that would steal away his brain? Yeah. What else did he say there in Macbeth? About drink provokes the desire but takes away the performance. Do you dig that? Well, I believe he knew what he was talking about. But on the other hand, when we say, well, you know, after all, how would I know? How do I know about this God that you talk about, this spiritual person, this divine being? How am I to know? You have feelings, have you not? So, well, yeah, but somebody had to tell me about it, of course. How do you know anything other than it is recommended to you? We put faith and everything else, don't you? If you had an ulcer and it was bothering you, you wouldn't pick up a telephone book and say, let me look under use and see if I can find ulcer. No. That ain't the way you'd go about it. So you got a bad stomachache. So you don't know how to make a decision to turn your will and your life over the care of God. You say, well, no, I don't know. I just can't believe all this. But you go to meetings and you hear people talk and you hear them tell about what has happened to them. Now, because of his work. So he beat the man or the woman that's had an ulcer. And he said, there anything wrong with his gut? And he said, well, look, go to my doctor. He's a good doctor. Now, you don't know this doctor, but your friend recommended him to you. So you accept that because your friend said so. Now, you don't know this doctor, so you go anyway. You make an appointment. You believe what your friend said because you believe your friend. So you go to the doctor and you don't know nothing about the man. The man says, strip, and here's the man you never saw before in your life. Step and take off all your clothes. You never saw him before. So he pummels and he hits and bangs and carries on and asks you about the pain. Now, he writes on a piece of paper, and you can't read what he wrote. And he tells you to take it to the pharmacist. You don't know the pharmacist either, do you? All right, your friend told you to go to the doctor. You knew your friend. You don't know the doctor, but you go to the doctor because your friend said so. Okay. You made a decision to go because your friend said so. Then you believe what your friend said because he helped your friend. I'm your friend, you see, he helped me. So, okay. You take this piece of paper from this man that you never saw before in your life that you just pulled your clothes off in front of, and you go over here to this man, another man with another white coat on, with a note You can't read what it says, and you hand it to him. He could have wrote on there, give somebody something to kill him with. You know what it says. But you take that note over there, and he gives you a bottle of something, and you pay him for it, and you go home and you drink it. Because your friend said so. And it begins to help you. You know, that's the way it works in AA. Take it from your friend in AA. If he made a decision, why don't you try to make it? Try. If your friend suggested, then let your decision determine your destiny. Let your friend help you, too. That's the way the third step works. Over to the care of. Say, introduced to you by your friend. That's the way it works. Now, as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, road under construction. That will be the fourth step. The fourth step, that tells me, made a searching and thorough small inventory of ourselves. Road under construction. And when one takes a searching and thorough small inventory of himself, the road is naturally, my friends, under construction. What are some of the things that cause the road to be under construction? Many times there are holes in the road. Holes. Yeah. Which tells us that there's something missing, just like in our lives. Life has become meaningless because there is something missing. I don't know what's missing out of your life, but I know what was missing out of mine. You know, I had withdrawn from people. I had run people away from me. I had lost all contact with anything that was decent. There was vacancies there. There was holes in the road. It had to be filled with something. Now, if you find a hole in the road, you won't find anybody out there just dumping water in it. You won't find anybody out there just filling it up with sawdust. We've got to put something there that's going to say. We must. You say, oh, there's no mess in the program. And then you must read the big book because there's some there. That's for sure. Okay. Now, of course, you probably don't have this here in your part of your world, which is very beautiful here, because you don't have the severe winters that we have at home. And at home, we have very severe winters, which I'm sure you've heard about. And there's enormous amounts of salt that is poured on the road. And this does great damage to the road because salt eats away at the road. It causes the road to corrode. At the time that the salt was poured on the road, we thought it made it easier to drive. But after driving was over with, look at what it has done. Just like when we drank, we thought that made it easier. This salt that eats away is that resentment that we have. Resentment that eats away night and day. That resentment that I'm too big a coward to talk about. That resentment that I can't talk about but that I drink about. The salt poured on the road. There are many parts of, I don't know whether you have it here or not, but at home we do. Many parts of the city that large trucks are permitted to go because large trucks cause too much pressure on the road. And this, too, is detrimental to the road. Look at the pressures that you and I have put on ourselves when we take this searching and fearless small inventory because the road is under construction. Look at the pressure you and I. We like to say the job put pressure on you. We like to say other people did. But oh no. I put it on me because I wanted to be first. I wanted to be most. I wanted to be all things to all people, and I wound up being nothing to nobody. This pressure. See, this pressure gave me an excuse to drink, because then I could tell everybody, oh, you know, mother's under so much pressure. That's why mother has to drink. Mother volunteered for anything. It wouldn't pull a flagpole sitting in anything, so I could say, there's like a pressure on me. You know, this gives us the greatest excuse in the world, because I'm under pressure. You and I love to be under pressure. We've flourished under pressure. Another good excuse to get drunk. Yeah. We invented pressure where there wasn't no pressure. So people would feel sorry for us. Oh, I can understand why poor so-and-so drinks. He's under so much pressure. He wasn't under the damn thing but the doofle or the table or something like that. He wasn't under no pressure. Nuh-uh. And then again, change of temperature causes a road to buckle. You know, going from hot to cold causes a road to buckle. That tears the road up too. Indecision. That's what that change of temperature is, indecision. One day, anything anybody does is fine. We laugh about it. It's great. The next day, somebody else can drop a pea in the mashed potatoes and you raise hell. You ain't all that noise for. You can't stand anything. One day, the job is wonderful. The next day, somebody says, take that chewing gum out of your mouth, and you get mad, I'm quitting. Indecision. We can't get along with anybody. See? We've now reached that point, you know, where we want everybody to turn their life and their will over to our keeping, and we can't take care of our own. But if you just do what I tell you to do, me and you can get along, we can make it. But you can't do what I tell you to do, we can't make it. And then you ask him the next day, what did you tell me to do? You know what I said? He didn't forget what he said himself, but he thinks you ought to know. And decision, you don't know. So I have to take a searching and fearless small inventory. Now, there is a line down the road, that line that says this car's still over here and that car's still over there. Let's look at the moral line. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Let's look at that. Now, it didn't say amoral. You know, you and I are always reading something into the program that's not there. It doesn't say amoral. It doesn't say immoral. It says moral. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Didn't say I didn't have any. Didn't say they were bad. It says moral inventory. Okay. That line got rubbed out, didn't it? The rain and the use of the road rubbed that line right out, just like the use of alcohol rubbed that moral line right out of our lives, did it not? Remember the time you would say, well, you know, when I get that bad, I'll quit drinking. When I get that bad, when I get that low. Finally, you know those goals that you set for yourself? That line just got rubbed out, didn't it? So finally, you were over the line and you wonder how you got over there. You kept inching to it closer and closer to it all the time and saying, you know, when I get that bad, I'm going to quit. Oh, my morals have never been that low. Never. But I, every drink that I took, I was rubbing that line out, 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 out. Yeah. So finally, it was no longer there. That's why it's necessary that I take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. So I can put that line back there again. That line that got rubbed out. Because the more liquor that I drank, the fainter and fainter that line grew. That's why they say a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, slow, do not pass. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong, slow. Easy does it, slow, but do not pass. Oh, when I first saw that, I said, oh, no way in the world, I'm going to take a fifth step. No way. One of my sponsors says, no, you can't take a fifth step because you don't know what it is. That's why you can't take one. You know what you're talking about. See, I had to have something to rebel against. So it's always good to rebel against something that you don't understand. Yeah. That makes rebellion real great. So she said, well, why aren't you going to take a fifth step? I said, oh, admit to God and myself the exact nature of my wrongs. She said, yes. Oh, she said, well, tell me, what does that mean to you? I said, well, I don't know, but I'm not going to do it. So then she began to explain to me. And then we began to go to the tables where they had, you know, where they talked about the fifth step, where I could understand what they meant when they talked about that fifth step. You know, what are we talking about? Slow, but do not pass. Motive. Motive. When one admits to God and himself and another human being, and I love that word. Couldn't it very easily say admit to God, ourselves, and another person, the exact nature of our wrongs? But it says another human being. It means that I'm going to talk to somebody that's got compassion, somebody that has understanding, somebody that has feeling, not somebody that's going to say, oh, you did. How could you do that? But, you know, it is, you're going to talk to somebody that loves, that knows, that has lived. You see, if you haven't walked that walk, you can't talk that talk no how. You know? You got to know it. You got to feel it right down in here. Yeah. Many of us get frightened about the fifth step. Even after I found out what it was, at first I didn't know what it was, and I found out what it was, I was scared of it. But it's very simple. The exact nature, motive. See, a child might wet his clothes because he doesn't know any better. Or he might wet his clothes because he hasn't been trained any better. Yeah. Or he might wet his clothes because he's ill. Or he might wet his clothes for attention. You understand what I'm talking about? What was his motive? You're not going to beat him because he doesn't know any better. You certainly aren't going to beat him because he's sick. But if he's doing it just for attention, you might tear his hide up a bit. You know, many things that you and I think are so horrible. Did you look at the motive, the exact nature? Not what you did, but your reason or excuse for doing it. Many times things that you and I did, we did them not because we were bad people. We did bad things, but why did you do them? You were lonely. See, loneliness has caused more crime than poverty ever dreamed of. If you and I hadn't withdrawn from people, we hadn't pushed people away from us. And then you and I got lonely and we got in a bind, we got in trouble, didn't we? See, loneliness. If someone said, well, what was you doing over such and such a place? Or how did that actually happen? Sometimes, you know, we want to lie about it and like, oh, you know what I mean, man, you know, after all, I was over there raising whoopee, I was doing this or that. I just wanted to show you how great I am. You were over there, baby, because you were lonely and nobody wanted you, and anybody that did, you was scared to go near them. And you got lonely and you got into trouble just like I did. That's how we got into trouble, because we were lonely. And loneliness has caused an awful lot of problems. So when you look at the fifth step, the exact nature, the motive, that's exactly, that's what it's talking about to me. We're not all that bad. We're sick, we're sad. Sure, we do bad things. But it's just like the child that wet his clothes. If you did it for attention or for spite, go to be evil or ugly. But sometimes we did it out of soul sickness because you had nothing, nowhere to turn. You know? And anything would have looked good to you at that time. Because your heart was bleeding. Exact nature of my wrongs. Yeah. See, you got to learn to be honest with yourself. That's where, you know, we still want to be big shot. Oh, yeah, man, you know, I was over there with Lucy May or Johnny May or somebody or other. You know, because I'm such a Don Juan or Theta Bear. I know you weren't. You was over there, baby, because you didn't have nowhere else to go. Yeah. Look at it. Face the truth. Face yourself and face the truth. Well, as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign on the road that says the detour. You know? Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Detour. Now, unless you're bent on self-destruction, you can ignore that sign that says the detour. You know, there's times that's when we have to start using slogans many times that this program teaches us. There was a time when you're driving along, you know, where the bridge got washed out, and you say, well, I know the bridge got washed out, but I made it that time, so I think I can make it this time. You see, the sign said detour, the bridge is washed out, but you think you're going to make it anyway. The big book says, we thought we could hold on to our old ideas. You see, the river done rose higher now. You may not be able to make it this time, so maybe we better get rid of some of them old ideas. Then all of a sudden, remember, entirely what we're ready to do. Entirely ready to have God to remove all these defects of character. This, oh, all of a sudden I'm back now, you know, I've got to be ambitious. I got to step on people. Oh, is this ambition or is it greed? There's a slogan there that says to live and to let live, you know. So I have to pay attention to that. Yeah. Oh, I must get to the top. There's no top in AA. Not a bit of top. You know, we're not looking for quantity sobriety. We're looking for quality sobriety. Quality. That's what we're looking for, quality. And there's no top to get to. If there is, you get there one day at a time. All of a sudden, well, you know, I can't stay sober unless our things go my way. I can't stay sober unless I have my husband back or my wife back. I can't stay sober. First things first. You ain't gonna have nothing back unless you stay sober. If you do, it ain't gonna stay with you no how. First things first. Well, you know, if I don't have it back, I'll get drunk. Well, if it didn't want you when you were sober, it sure in hell don't want you when you're drunk. But first things first. And then again, I wished I could want to stay sober. Have you ever heard anybody say that? Have you ever felt that way yourself? I wished I could want to stay sober.
I wish I could want to. Well, action is the magic word. Some of us go further than that. I wish I could wish I want to stay sober. I wish I could wish I could want to. We put two wishes in one want. Just take out both wishes and start wanting. That's all. And then again, you know, we get sober and we stay sober for about 15 minutes. Now we're going to criticize everybody else, you know, just having it go.
Look at him!
Yeah, yeah. But for the grace of God, it could be me. You know, be there to help him because, bless his heart, some of our brothers and sisters are just a little bit sicker than others. Remember, you too were once a stranger within the gates. Now, as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we see a sign in the road. There's a little bitty sign, but you don't want to pay much attention to them because, you know, that's the shortest step. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Very short step, but very, very great step. See, these are the bumps and the curves. What are some of the bumps and the curves? Well, pretense is one of them. That's a bump. Pretense. When I am pretending to stay sober, I just pretend that I'm staying sober. By pretense, I am not staying sober for me. I am staying sober to get what I want. And then when I get what I want, I'm going to quit. Now, that's pretension. You're not staying sober for you, then, are you? You're staying sober to get what you want. In other words, you're not even staying sober. You're just dry. You just ain't drinking that day. You know? Because a sober person stays sober for himself. There's nobody else you can stay sober for anyway. Yeah. So pretense. That's one of the bumps, one of the curves there. Yeah. So I have to watch these bumps and curves. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. See, my shortcomings, these are the things that lead back to my character defect, my shortcomings. These are the clothespins that hold resentments on the line. It's my shortcomings. That's it. See, well, you say, I don't have to pay any attention to that. You just can't throw a silk blanket over a mule and make a racehorse out of him. It don't work like that. You might as well get rid of it. Shortcomings. Yeah. Now, let us look at procrastination. You know, this procrastination, that's another one of my shortcomings. You know, well, so when I look, why'd you stop coming to the program? Well, you know, I don't have, and women are good at this, I didn't have anything to wear. That's why I don't come. I don't have anything to wear. What'd you wear the night you did that striptease? Yeah. Well, I've come to the program. You know, I'm going to start coming to meetings, you know, but there's a couple more parties I want to attend. Why don't you just come out and say you want to get drunk a few more times, you know? But, might as well be honest. Well, I would come, you know, but there's nobody to keep the kids. Who kept them when you was on the couch drunk? They're watching over you. You wasn't watching over them. Well, my shortcomings, I'm using this excuse. Humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. Yeah. And then, you know, I intend to come to meetings as soon as I get my license back. I lost my license. And I'll get him back. If you wanted to drink, you didn't need no license, did you? You walked. And then you got a cab, and you drove it home in a cab because you're scared you might fall down and break it. So you give it a ride home in a cab, you know? You give it double coverage, in other words. You carried it and rode it. And now somebody says, why don't you come to the meetings? Well, you know, I don't have any license. One of my shortcomings. I'm still lying. I'm still using excuses. Yeah. Looking for a reason. Yeah. Then every once in a while, somebody, you know, might say, you know, look, I don't think you're being too honest. Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about those pills. Well, you know, I always tell you, I said, well, why don't you tell your doctor? One of your shortcomings is you're not explaining this to your doctor that you're an alcoholic and you can't be taking all them pills. Well, as soon as I get over the hump, you know, I'm going to tell my doctor that, not to give me these pills anymore, but, right now I need to take them. Because, you know, I have trouble sleeping. I get so tired of laying that night counting sheep. Well, if you talk to the shepherd, baby, you won't count sheep. You know. And then another shortcoming you have is that reservation. Oh, well, you know, I just don't think I really, I don't really believe that I'm an alcoholic. You know, it can't happen to me. It's, you know, it's not on my social level. Have you ever spelled the word level? It spells the same way backwards as it does forward. Level is level. It really does. Write it down. Look at it if you don't believe it. Yeah, it does.
Well, you know, after all, I don't believe I'm an alcoholic because there never was any alcoholics in my family. Well, you break the tradition and be the first. Yeah, as far as that's concerned. Well, you know, I don't need to go to AA because, you know, I've gone back to church. Well, the priest never left church, but he still comes to AA as far as that's concerned, you know. Yeah. Well, you know, after all, I don't need to come to AA because I'm in therapy. Oh, baby, the therapist needs to be there, too, you know. Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, after all, I really think, you know, I have a degree now. Oh, I love this one. You know, I have a degree now, so, and I'm counseling alcoholics. I'm working with alcoholics, and I have a degree. So I don't need to come to AA because I got a degree. Well, you know, thermometers have a degree. And if you don't have your fellow man's welfare at heart, you might as well do the same thing with that degree as you do with some thermometers. Shove it. You know? That's the truth. Because, you know, friends, this is a program of the heart. It really is. You got to put your heart in it, you know? That's for sure. Now, let us travel briefly or quickly on our journey into sobriety here. We now see a sign in the road that takes care of steps 8 and 9. It says, watch for ice on the bridge, you know? Made a list of all persons we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Watch for ice on the bridge. Watch. You know, this ice on the bridge, sometimes, friends, when we start to try to make amends, you know, there's a very thin line between humility and stupidity. You know? Sometimes we're so eager to get back into people's good graces that we become a doormat, and the big book speaks against that. We do not become a doormat for anybody. Remember, my friends, you represent royalty. You are a child of God. See, humility wears the cloak of dignity. You know? So we do not become a doormat. It is very true. The first amend I must make is to myself. And that's the greatest one. That's the hardest one anyway. And that is to forgive ourselves. Many times it's so hard for you and I to forgive ourselves because we have such big egos. How could I have done that? You did it because you were human. Oh, how could I? You did. I did. And I did it as a human being, and I've got to forgive myself as a human being. Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes we can't forgive ourselves, and then we have problems with other people. Here you want to go back telling somebody, you know, I love you more than I love myself, and that's one of the biggest lies ever was. I don't want to be bothered with nobody that loves me more than they do themselves. You know, No. See, the Bible says to love thy neighbor as thyself. So any time that you love me more than you do yourself, you're up to something, and I don't trust you. You know? Mm-mm. Oh, no. You do me in. I didn't go in for that. No. So when it comes down to amends, my friends, you see, amends, I don't mean restitution. Restitution is made with the hands. You can be made to make restitution. Amends is made with the heart. I've got to really feel it. It says I've got to become willing. That takes some feeling. That takes some doing. Yeah? It don't come overnight. It takes some time. You say, well, I'm not willing yet. Well, just wait. It says that we became willing. Don't always happen overnight. It takes some mellowing to become willing. And if I do anything else before that, before I am willing to do it, then it is sheer hypocrisy. And I've been a hypocrite all of my life. And I'm not going to make any amends until I become willing. That mellowness. Because, okay, if I go ahead and I try to straighten out something, just to get something else or to get somewhere else, and then things don't go my way, I'm going to become resentful again. So I've got to become willing. So that regardless of whatever happens, it won't make any difference because I'm doing the thing that my heart tells me to. You see, your mind can cheat your heart. Don't let your mind cheat your heart. So, well, I know I got to do this, but I don't want to. Mm-mm. I want to. See, I make amends because I've got to be at peace with me.
I got to be at peace with me. I got to sleep with me. You know? And I got to be at peace with me. I got to make amends to my fellow man because, you know, if I don't, I got to eat with him, and I got to sleep with him, and I got to walk with him and talk with him. And I don't want to sleep with everybody. That ain't right. No, that's against the laws of nature, you know. So I'd rather be at peace with you. And then you sleep where you sleep, and I sleep where I sleep. But if not, I'm not at peace with you. Every time I turn around, your image is there. Your image is in my cup. Your image is in my plate. And I don't want you there. So I make peace. So I can have peace within me, you know. You know, my friends, I have to also remember to watch for that ice on the bridge because I might be rejected. And I too must remember, look, Holly, you too made people crawl. You too would withhold love from people. You did this. You withheld love from people. Why did you do that? Because you hurt so damn bad yourself you wanted to hurt everybody else. So, okay, if you are rejected, you know why? All that you know is, look, I'm not playing a game, I'm staying sober for myself. I'm trying to make amends because I have become willing so that I can live with me. But if you do not want to accept my amends, then that is your bag, and then you keep on trying to live with you. It's just that simple. But the whole thing starts out is with my willingness within me. But if there is rejection, that is why, my friends, the second and third step is so important. In the event that I am rejected, I will not slide on that ice. And that is made of many persons. You see, this is really will tell you whether you are staying sober for you or whether you are staying sober for what you can get. Because when you are rejected and you go out here and you get drunk, you wasn't staying sober for you know how. Say, well, I tried to do this and I tried to do that and look what they did. So I might as well go on and get drunk. You wasn't staying sober for you. Say, well, it's a long journey, but it's a fair journey. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, no U-turn. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. That's a 10th step. No U-turn. Now, what are some of the U-turns that causes a person? See, along with that sign, many times you'll see another sign in the road that will tell you, authorized vehicles only. Well, that's for the man or woman that comes in the program and says, well, I've had a course in AA. You know, I know what it's all about. Know what it's all about. I got it made. Okay. He's authorized to go on back out if he wants to. He's an authorized vehicle if he wants to turn around because he knows everything. Now, you know, he's just like the, what you might say, intelligent idiot. Knows everything. See, the intelligent idiot walks up to a man one day and he had a bird in his hand. And he said, I'm going to ask this wise man. He walked up to the wise man. He says, I'm going to ask this wise man, is this bird dead or alive? If he tells me this bird is dead, I'll let it go free. If he says the bird is alive, I'm going to squeeze it to death. So as he walked up to the wise man, he said, wise man, tell me. He had his bird in his hand behind his back. He said, wise man, tell me, is this bird dead or alive? The wise man said, look, the answer is not important, fool, but the decision is because it rests in your hands. And that's exactly where it is. It's okay. Mm-hmm. So you see, that decision, whether you want to be an authorized vehicle or not, is up to you. But now, what are some of the U signs when it says no U-turn? Well, continue now to take personal inventory when you're wrong, promptly meant. Sickness. Well, sometimes we get sick and we say, well, you know, I might as well take me a drink. I'm sick. So what? You ever got sick when you was drunk? You got sick then. Well, the alcohol didn't make you well. You thought it did, but it didn't. So, okay, so you break your leg or something happens. Well, somebody in your family gets sick. Well, I couldn't stand to see so-and-so suffer, so I took a drink. Now, both of you sick, then. So I have to take a search and continue to take this inventory and try to look. I was new people when they were sick, when I was drinking, and that didn't make them well. So no need of me getting drunk now about it. Then again, you know, said, well, I lost my job. So I go, so I went back and I started drinking because I lost my job. Do you know one thing? You probably didn't want that job anyway, but you didn't have guts enough to quit it. Yeah. So you wanted to quit it. You hated the daggone job. But you're scared to quit it because you was afraid to go look for another one.
And so you hoped a man would fire you, and so since he did fire you, this is your excuse to get another job but get drunk before you get it. You know? That's what you call double indemnity, you know. One of them guys. I know the name because I play the game, I know. You know. Then again, well, you know, after all, I was going along so nice, and here I was trying to stay sober. And they served divorce papers on me. So you went out and got drunk because they served divorce papers on you. So you played right into the hands, didn't you? They told you, look, I'm going to divorce you drunk or sober because you ain't no good. Say, I'm going to divorce you for the simple reason is you're going to get drunk again anyway. And you prove it to them by going out getting drunk. Yeah, you prove it to them. So they served divorce papers because they knew you was going to get drunk again, and that just helped you on your way, so you aren't. So you said, well, okay, I'll prove it. So then again, you know, well, I got drunk. You turn now. I got bored. So I don't know, I go to those meetings, they say the same thing over and over. You went to the bar and drank the same thing over and over. But I got bored, so you know, I got drunk. You got bored. You wouldn't go out and buy a stick of dynamite just because you got constipated, would you? All right, now, so why am I going out and get drunk? Because I got bored. That's stupid. You know. So these kind of things, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. That lack of attention. Oh, sometimes, you know, when we come in the program, it says continue to take personal inventory along, promptly admit it. Like, when you come in the program, you know, you was a baby. Everybody babied you. They poured your coffee. They stirred it. They even saucered it and blowed it for you, you know. Because you was a baby. You know, and everybody makes over the baby. Uh-huh. Now, a new baby comes along, and you're not the baby no more. That ain't paying no attention to me. You go out and you get drunk. See, the new baby, you are supposed to be in there pulling for that new baby, because why? You just recently got sober, and that new person can identify with you better than he can with me, because there's a difference there. You know, he can identify with me, but you see, you just came in. And he feels closer to you than he would even to me. You know? I sit down and I say, you know, okay, well, okay. Somebody said, well, how many years you got? I said, well, I got 23 years. Oh, he said, oh, my Lord, I can't stay sober long with you. I'm sorry. Oh, I got 3 months. Well, he can see that, you know. But now, just because, and so you're supposed to be there and help him. But no, you're going out and get drunk just because you're not the baby no more. You just like Willie, you know, Willie, little Willie, you know, after all, he's supposed to be house broke now and all like that. His mama comes back from the hospital with a new baby, you know. Still little Willie, teaching little Willie how to diaper the baby and help the baby. Uh-oh, little Willie don't like this. He says, I'll fix the baby, pay me no attention, I'm going to start peeing again, you know. And that's exactly what we do. You act, that's your immaturity. Grow up. Continue to take personal inventory, and you're wrong, promptly admit it. You know that isn't right. So now as we travel on our journey to sobriety, we now see a beautiful sign in the road. Gas, food, and lodging. Next exit. Gas, food, and lodging. Next exit. By now, weary traveler, this sign looks good to you. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Gas, food, and lodging. Just what are we talking about when we talk about gas, food, and lodging? Well, let me tell you. Remember, up there in the first step, when we said we were powerless. See, a car won't run without gas. Gas is what gives it power. See, we'd quit running. Now, gas, sought through prayer and meditation. Gas. Prayer is power. Food, spiritual food. Meditation. Spiritual food. Lodging, AA. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. You see, I cannot improve upon a conscious contact with someone that I haven't met. So hence the second and third steps, again, I have met them. In other words, I am now in the recovery room of AA. And I love that, being in the recovery. You see, we have had one of the greatest operations that anybody could have as a sick person. The greatest operation that any man or woman can have is a personality operation. And only the master surgeon can give you this personality operation. and I will be in the recovery room as long as I live. You see, when one has had a great operation, he's placed in the recovery room, and there's always a very efficient nurse in there that has taken his four vital signs, you know, pulse and respiration and blood pressure and that sort of thing, temperature. Now, you and I can see the four vital signs of the alcoholic. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity. The four vital signs. And at the slightest deviation of any of my four vital signs, while I'm in this recovery room, I don't need to call on a nurse. I can fall on my knees. When I get up off of my knees, I can go to a meeting. And there they sit, all of them. And you and I will always be in the recovery room. Yeah? And watching these four vital signs. Because of why? This sign that I now see. Gas. Yes. I have the power. Praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. Dead gas. Food. Spiritual food. It's right there in the 11th step. Now, as we come to the end of our journey, it's just the end for this day. It starts again tomorrow. It starts again every day. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. We now see a sign in the road that says, end of divided highway. You know, merging traffic. It means that I must try to practice these principles in all my affairs. End of divided highway. Merging traffic, I will practice these principles in all my affairs with everyone. Not just an AA. It's marvelous to be a good, shall we say, member in the presence of my fellow man. But what about when I am not in the presence of my fellow man? I am still in the presence of my God, am I not? I am still in the presence of myself. And this is why it is so very... In other words, I learn to practice these principles. Not compromise principles, but practice them. And if any man that I must compromise for, then I must give him the distance he so well deserves. Because I think that you and I would all like to say, when that final day does come, like Paul, I fought the good fight. I finished my course. I kept the faith. Now God bless you.